Men who look upon themselves born to reign and others to obey soon grow insolent. Selected from the rest of mankind, their minds are early poisoned by importance, and the world they act in differs so materially from the world at large that they have but little opportunity of knowing its true interests. And when they succeed to the government, are frequently the most ignorant and unfit of any throughout the dominions.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Today, we'll be discussing Thomas Paine's political treatise, Common Sense, which was published on the 10th of January, 1776. About 7 months before the Declaration of Independence. In those 7 months, about 120,000 copies were sold, and by the end of the Revolution, 500,000 copies were sold. And this is out of a total population of 2.5 million people. So we can say that 1 in 5 Americans purchased Common Sense. And just to compare those numbers to now, if Common Sense were published today, it would sell a staggering 70 million copies. That's a lot. I think it's safe to say that Common Sense did more to push the average American to support full rebellion than any other text. But more on all of these points later, because I have a very special guest today to discuss Thomas Paine and the Declaration of Independence and Common Sense, Professor Nora Slonimsky. Welcome, Nora.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nora is Associate Professor of History at Iona University, and for this episode, it's really important to realize that she is also the director of the Institute for Thomas Paine Studies in New Rochelle, New York. Her first book, The Engine of Free Expression, Copyrighting the State in Early America, will be published by the University of Pennsylvania Press in the spring of 2026. So I might add that New Rochelle is where Thomas Paine died, and it's quite sad that he died alone and penniless and loved by practically no one. And it's remarkable that we are discussing him today as an American hero and even as a giant of world history when he was friendless and forgotten at the end of his own life, which just goes to show you that book sales do not equal wealth and fame in one's own lifetime. So, Nora, you chose actually a passage from Common Sense to read in that introduction, but many people might have heard that and thought, oh, was that in the Declaration of Independence? It sounds quite similar. So why did you choose that quotation to begin?
So that quotation to me, which is very multi-layered, right? There's a lot you can get out of Paine's writing in just those few sentences and get a real sense of what life is like in the late 18th century, what the stakes are in colonial North America, and what everyday colonial Americans are thinking about, right? Paine is really speaking to them. But what is particularly striking about the language of that quotation, that part of Common Sense, and its relation to the Declaration of Independence is a fairly singular focus on the problem of hereditary rule. And the Declaration is very, very focused on King George and the failings of the British monarchy to treat British subjects in North America with the respect and dignity and equality of subjects in England and other parts of the United Kingdom. And Paine is picking up on a very similar thread in Common Sense, but maybe zooming out, right? Looking at hereditary rule writ large as opposed to one ruler.
Right, and the other echoes that I see there, obviously, are simply the direct criticisms of King George, which we see throughout the Declaration of Independence. And I think Thomas Jefferson's language in the Declaration is pretty harsh on King George. He has some passages in there that are pretty brutal. But I think it's fair to say that Thomas Paine's language about hereditary kings is even more brutal and venomous.
Yeah, so I think in some ways they're parallel takes on monarchy, but they are distinct, to your point, right? So in the Declaration, you are focusing on a very specific action, which is separating from the British government, of which King George is the head, right? So King George is going to be the subject of your ire in a pretty direct way, because he's the person you are essentially, for lack of a better word, breaking up with, right? He's the person who's you're ending the relationship with. Paine has the luxury in a longer form pamphlet like Common Sense, right? Common Sense is a pretty brief read, all things being considered, especially compared to the much lengthier texts of Enlightenment and Empire that are really dominating the 18th century, but it is still longer than the Declaration. So he has a bit more room to really dig into the details of why. So while George is clearly a central focus of Common Sense, he's concerned about monarchy writ large, right? He's concerned about kings in any capacity, not just necessarily those in England.
Yeah, and I really love this line here. When kings do eventually succeed to the government, they are frequently the most ignorant and unfit of any throughout the dominion. So essentially, the average English person worships the king. He's saying actually the king is the most ignorant and unfit to lead, which is again really fun.
There's many, many things about Common Sense that are fascinating, but the title in and of itself, right? Paine is referencing things that many of us sort of intuitively observe, right? And if you take kind of the familial metaphor, right? If someone is spoiled, right? If someone is not really given a strong work ethic, or if someone is told from the time they are born that they are, perfect and precious and everything is wonderful. And yes, of course, we should be telling children that they are all of those things, but also balanced with a healthy sense of self-awareness and obligations to others and your community, and we might describe as civic duty. If you lack those sort of contexts, right? If you lack that experience, then you're kind of set up to fail from the beginning. So in many ways, what Paine is talking about, why kings become so ignorant and unfit, is because they were never really given the tools to be anything other. They were not given the same skills that everyday people who grew up in having more of those perspectives, we could say, would have.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point. Now, we started in medias res, as it were, with the passage from Common Sense, but let's go and actually get to know Thomas Paine. And mm-hmm. I think you could say the biggest difference between Thomas Paine and King George was that Thomas Paine was a self-made man. So let's just go and why don't you tell our audience, who was Thomas Paine?
Yes, Thomas Paine grew up in very different circumstances than the British monarchy and the British aristocracy, that is for sure. He was born in a town called Thetford in England in 1737 to what we might describe today essentially like a working class household. His father, who was a pretty observant Quaker, was a corset maker, and his mother was the daughter of the town clerk, which you can then draw the conclusion it was very likely she was Anglican if she grew up in a household with that kind of civic identity. So it's curious too that he grew up in a multi-faith household, and may also from a very early age highlight his more tolerant or open-minded views about religion and faith. The first 20 or so years of his life, he tries out different professions like many of us. He kind of tries to find his footing. He dabbles here and dabbles there. And I should also note that he does go through some personal trauma. He loses his first wife in childbirth, and that seems to profoundly affect him in many ways for the rest of his life. But he eventually reemerges and settles down in a town called Lewes, which is a beautiful town in the south of England. Thetford, I should say, is lovely as well, where he marries again, and he and his wife open a store where they sell groceries, tobacco, other things. It's that house is still in existence today. It's called Bull House, and it's run by a wonderful organization, Thomas Paine Legacy, if anyone's ever in the area and wants to check it out. But his primary occupation while in Lewes is as an excise agent, or what we call a tax collector. And while he's participating in the work of tax collecting, which is an essential activity for any kind of civil or civic needs of the town, the region, the country, right? He also becomes very involved in a debating society. And so you see this combination of we might say government work with discourse and debate, really merging hand in hand. And another interesting thing about Lewis, which also really I think is shaping or very influential on Paine in this period, is that Lewis is not a royally chartered town, in that it has a fair amount of, we might say, sort of democratic autonomy there. And so Paine becomes very immersed in sort of local democratic action as well, which is another sort of curious aspect of his development as a thinker, as a writer, as an activist, and all these hats that he will eventually come to wear.
And I just want to cycle back very briefly, because I don't want to give the audience an impression that somehow Thomas Paine was totally uneducated or that he was the working of working class. I mean, he did go to school. He did learn. I think he was exposed to Latin. I think I read somewhere that his dad did not like the fact that he could learn Latin and kind of said, well, Latin is, you know, basically something for the upper classes, not for us working folk. But he was actually given, for the time, a solid, maybe high school education, yeah?
Yes, yeah. Paine was indeed an educated person. I think it's all, for lack of a better word, it's relative to when we think about sort of the philosophes of the Enlightenment or leading figures in the American Enlightenment. He would not have had the same kind of access that many of those peers would have had. And I do think that is important because Paine very firmly believed in education for all, in so many words, and that education needed to be accessible to as wide amount of people as possible, and that even if it wasn't necessarily quote-unquote essential to your day-to-day labor, your day-to-day work, learning and intellectual engagement was a right for everybody, that it brought sort of, in so many words, sort of joy and fulfillment into your life, no matter what that professional capacity would be. That said, he does have a degree of training. He is not entirely self-taught, I'm thinking of that movie, Good Will Hunting, you know, one of these sort of proteges who sort of emerge with absolutely no structures whatsoever. No, he does. But a lot of that expansion of his education does take place in Lewis, in these debating societies, in these civic groups, where there is a lot of intellectual interaction.
Right. And maybe I just want to highlight two more points from what you just said. Going back to the multi-faith household he was in, his father was a Quaker. And one important point about Quakerism, which connects to education, is that Quakers believe that human beings could improve themselves. It's a very positive understanding of human nature, that we can do better. And education was a key feature in self-improvement and becoming more Jesus-like or more pure. And so obviously you can see that maybe a Quaker influence in Thomas Paine's lifelong concepts and beliefs in egalitarianism, such as education should be free for all people.
Yes, yeah, that's very well put. Paine does not have necessarily what I would describe as a Quaker identity in the vein of many of his peers, particularly in Pennsylvania, right, will come to have or do have. But it certainly, I would describe, as a formative influence on him in his early years. I think that is very safe to say.
Okay, so here we have Thomas Paine. He's the excise officer. And I think maybe we briefly need to mention that he wrote a first pamphlet on behalf of other excise officers. And maybe that's where we start seeing him really developing his political education and his style as a writer.
Yes, absolutely. So I often will have students be like, oh, common sense. How did he just write that like off the cuff? How is it the first thing he ever wrote? And I'm like, curiously enough, right, it's not the first thing he wrote. It's his second major publication. Of course, he is writing many other short form things in the early to mid 1770s. But his first long form publication is The Case of the Officers of Excise, which is both an interesting forerunner to common sense. You can definitely see the roots of his thinking, of his authorial voice, of his perspective. And yet it's also a very different book in ways that I find incredibly curious. One thing that's especially striking about it is that this is not a, quote, radical text. This is not advocating for an overthrow of government. It is not revolutionary in that sense. What it is essentially saying is, if we offer these improvements to our government agents involved in tax collecting, it will make the process better for everybody. It's a very working within institutions appeal as opposed to a critique of institutions from outside that he is more known for in Common Sense. So you see a really different side of him, a very practical side. Well, all of his work, I would say, is fairly practical, but you see a very sort of deliberate point that he is making, which is that excise officers are not treated very well. They are not well compensated. And their job is really tough. And that's something that I think folks who work with taxation through the present day can probably vouch for. It's not the easiest job. It's not going to make you the most popular person on the street. And excise officers were very vulnerable. And so he's really advocating for them in a way that is trying to work within existing structures to better the condition of his peers.
Okay, good. So here we have him doing his lobbying work and authorship for the Excise Officers Union, we might say.
Yeah.
And he publishes that in 1772, but shortly thereafter, he does leave for the United States. So why did he end up leaving to the U.S.?
Yeah, so he leaves
The United States, not...
Not quite yet.
Excuse me.
You're okay. So he leaves for British North America in 1774. And around this point, he had been forming many connections. Once again, he is part of this very vibrant intellectual community in Lewis, of people of all different statures and backgrounds. And he does come into contact with, via those networks, most famously with Benjamin Franklin. And Franklin becomes a very formative figure for Paine, along with so many others, right, in this moment, and essentially helps facilitate his move to North America. But he is undergoing a separation from his wife, Elizabeth, at this time. And Elizabeth is a very impressive woman in her own right. She's a businesswoman. She has resources of her own. And so within this legal separation, she essentially maintains autonomy over those resources, which is a huge deal for a woman, for a femme soul, to use the term, right, in this period. The separation is legally binding. It is formally recognized. And after the separation, and there's a lot of conflicting information and details about why they separated, what had happened in the marriage. I won't speculate too much about that here, but there is conflicting views about what might have happened. But he separates from Elizabeth. They go their separate ways. It seems that there is never really a bad word subsequently recorded about one thing about the other. So at the very least, the end of the relationship is a civil one. And then he heads to Philadelphia, and within a year and a half, Common Sense hits the, I don't know if it'd be the shelves, but hits the market.
Right. So, you know, a lot happened. And maybe in our remaining time, we have a lot of time, but sometimes it's not so important to think about the author. It's more important to think about the ideas. So maybe we'll focus more on the ideas expressed in Common Sense now. And let me just give a brief historical background or a context of what's going on at the time. It's published in January of 1776. And let's not forget, though, that in January of 1776, the rebellion had been going on for many months. In fact, April 19th, 1775, was the Battle of Lexington and Concord. And there had been several failed military campaigns from the soon-to-be U.S. colonies into Canada, the Canadian invasions, which were failures. So at the time that Common Sense hits the shelves, actually, it's kind of at a really critical time for the rebellion, for the revolution. Mm-hmm. Not everyone was supported it. In fact, the majority were maybe on the fence or certainly against it. And so what happens is this pamphlet comes out, and it really galvanizes the people who are wavering about, you know, is this revolution going well? Do we really want to support it? Young men need to think about, are we joining a militia? Are we going to join the Continental Army? And so it's not that Common Sense impelled people to start the rebellion. It came out at a time when they needed a final push to join it.
Yes. So Common Sense, I think, essentially, if you needed to distill it into a very short phrase, it tips the scales, right? That's really what it does. Oftentimes, we think of this period in very dichotomous ways, right? A binary of patriot, loyalist. And in reality, that is very, very far. And there's been wonderful work from scholars like Serena Zabin, for example, who have really shown us that there's a much richer, more complicated landscape of how people identify, even strictly within the confines of someone who would say, I am a colonial American, or I am a British subject, right? That doesn't even take into account the perspective of Indigenous Americans and all the different communities and nations within Indigenous North America, African Americans, African descended Americans, both enslaved and free, you know, women for whom there are certainly records, but also in much more limited ways where they might fit within this sort of spectrum of identity, you might say, right? So there's a lot of different people with a lot of different opinions and a lot of different perspectives. And, you know, if you had to break it down into a number, you could broadly say that maybe a third by the winter of 1776 have patriot or maybe patriot adjacent sensibilities. A third are like, oh no, like we're part of the British Empire. We're a part of kind of the most successful club, quote unquote, on earth from their perspective. We're going to stay. And then you have pretty much a third who are either deeply ambivalent or deeply disinterested for one way or another. And that probably actually charts in many respects to how large-scale political and economic choices, right? Because the revolution is indeed a political choice, but it is also an economic one, a social one too, depending on how far you think the revolutionary movement ultimately goes. And so when you think about it that way, something like Common Sense and the sort of very impressive statistics about its publication, which also themselves have garnered their own sort of set of controversies, no matter how many copies even you think was definitively sold, a lot were sold, right? A lot were out, and that's not even taking into account the discussions of them in taverns or coffee shops or in homes or on the street, right? The verbal communication that Common Sense also inspired. A lot of people are talking about it as well as reading it. And if you are in that maybe unsure category, or maybe if you are in that I'm disinterested category, for that matter, it could push you another way too, but it's gonna probably push you in one form or another. And that's essentially what Common Sense sets out to do, right? The original title of the pamphlet is Plain Truths. And I think that's a very revealing description, because it tells you that this is a pretty direct intention, a pretty straightforward goal of what this text is trying to do. And to your point about the author and the ideas, it can be tricky to separate them, right? Because people are very bound together with their intellectual and creative work. But certainly this is a straightforward aim of what it's trying to do. And it is at least in part, it's successful in that impetus. And you're really not going to see, I would say, perhaps a work quite on that scale again, perhaps until Uncle Tom's Cabin, when you see a same kind of intervention on a national, or in this case, sort of pan-colonial scale.
Yeah, I want to stress the popularity a little bit more too, because in previous episodes we've talked about the unique literary culture in the colonies. People presume, oh, the colonists, they're all a bunch of redneck farmers or whatever. But actually, the literacy rates were extremely high, mostly because of the Protestant faith's insistence that people read the Bible themselves. And what we see here is that just in those numbers of the copies that were sold, a lot of people could read. A lot of people could read a fairly complicated, although simple, political treatise. But that also doesn't sort of include all of the people who maybe couldn't read, who would still be exposed to it through, as you said, taverns and other places where political ideas would be discussed. Mm-hmm. So I think it's safe to say that everyone was talking about it, pretty much, even if you were a loyalist.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to find almost a contemporary media analogy. And I should say, for anyone who's listening, my path to Paine and to learning about Paine is very much as a historian of media and a historian of communication. I studied the history of copyright and authorship and its sort of commercial side effects or commercial intentions. So my path into Paine was, in many respects, those statistics and the discussion and debate about them. And what I think is super important to stress here is that because our current media landscape is much more fractured, and there are positives to that and there are negatives. We have social media, we have streaming, we have podcasts, we have radio, we have television, you know, we have film, we have all these different ways in which people interact with each other. In the late 18th century, pamphlets are the social media of their day, right? They are the ways in which people are, did you see what they said on X or what they posted on TikTok? Or did you see what they put on the news, right? This is all coming from this medium in a way that is truly extraordinary, right? You know, maybe there is an analogy in the history of television when you had six channels, right? There might be something there too. I would defer to my friends and colleagues in those fields who know that better than I, but it really is a remarkable impact because everyone is reading, or if they're not, if they haven't read it, they are talking about it in a way that it's hard to capture in our modern world, how much cohesion around this text there would have been.
Right. A real cultural touching point for all. Mm-hmm. Okay, but let's go into maybe the preface first. There are four sections, but I just pulled out my favorite passage from the preface, which is this. The cause of America is in a great measure the cause of all mankind. The cause of America is in a great measure the cause of all mankind. And I thought, oh man, that's pretty... That's a huge statement, but it's really interesting because I also see that, in the future, looking back, as maybe one of the key critical origin points of the concept of American exceptionalism, which now goes through all political parties and beliefs, this idea that the cause of America is in a great measure the cause of all mankind. But what do you think about that line?
Okay, well, Paine's not necessarily known for his modesty, and very few of his peers are. So that should be a very important preface that this is not a moment for sort of humility in the face of historical change. However, oddly enough, that particular phrase, as for lack of a better word, as how arrogant that might sound. Right, because we know about American exceptionalism and sort of the complications that has wrought, and the sort of legacy of the quote city upon a hill, and where that has sort of come to pass over centuries, because we know that now that phrase carries the weight of what came after, right? I think when we talk about it in the context of common sense in the winter of 1776. There's a real sincerity or earnestness that is not yet bogged down by all the pitfalls that will come after. And what I mean by that is Paine sincerely believes, as I think do many of his peers, that there's an opportunity here that perhaps has not been seen since, the Roman Republic. And even then, it was not going to look like this, right? To create a system of government or a nation state that could truly then turn those lessons outward and assist and support its peers around the world in creating sort of a global republic or a global spreading that egalitarian or that sort of those principles far and wide. Now, of course, we also know the sort of the problems and the challenges that are wrought by universalism, right? And we know we have the benefit too of hindsight and also of their contemporaries of knowing the problems of when you go into other parts of the world and tell them what to do without their permission. I don't know that quote is intended in that way, but rather being like, what we want here, people in other parts of the world also want, right? We want self-determination. We want dignity. We want the recognition of our rights as human beings. And while there's a million different ways in which and million languages and cultural practices that can and do interpret those ways in ways that are sort of authentic or sincere to their belief systems and their sovereignty, that is where I think Paine is actually going with that, as opposed to perhaps the ways in which it may have been used in down the road.
Right. And we see later then in other sections how he frequently returns to Europe and says that America has already been a haven to the persecuted in Europe's horrible kingdoms with their horrible brutish kings. And the U.S. should be a separate place. And then we see echoes of the Statue of Liberty and all the immigration politics going back 250 years. And so we see that already here in 1776, at the start of 1776, in Thomas Paine's work. All right, so let's go through the four sections quickly of the Common Sense. The first section is of the origin and design of government in general, with concise remarks on the English Constitution. And I just have one very short passage here that I liked. The prejudice of Englishmen in favor of their own government by king, lords, and commons arises as much or more from national pride than reason.
Again, a pretty bold take for someone who was until very recently an Englishman himself. Paine is very, I think, astutely there, and this is why I can't stress enough that what Common Sense has the ability to do, thanks to sort of the sort of space, which the Declaration does not necessarily have that luxury, is this very deep historical context that is driving these arguments. And Paine is responding to, in the vein of Milton and sort of Locke and other thinkers of sort of the preceding century, to a sense that the English Constitution is this sort of hallowed practice. And on the one hand, it is a remarkable practice, right? There is this slowly developing sort of democratic tradition over the course of medieval and early modern English history, where the Constitution and the balances of power that we might describe it as right today are growing. And there is a slowly developing tradition within those practices that recognizes the rights of different people in a way that it perhaps had not done so in the centuries before, right? And that means a lot to colonial North Americans. The almost mythology that has sprung up around the English Constitution is very sacred to them. It's something that they really value. And there's good reason to admire that work. On the other hand, what Paine is observing is that Constitution might not be doing all the work that you think it is, right? This might not be quite so perfect or flawless in the way that you think. So when you think of one of his peers like Hamilton, who is very steeped in constitutional law, right? And his assessment of the English Constitution or other interlocutors and their interpretations, Paine is far more critical of it. He sees what we have come to sort of describe it as the English Constitution over this centuries-long evolution of English common and statutory law and parliamentary practice. He thinks that it's not great for everyday people in North America. He's like, it's not giving you the rights that you think it is. It's just not doing that work. So a lot of that section is contravening what on the one hand is an understandable pride, and on the other hand is a pride that perhaps needs a little bit more self-reflection about what's going on.
Right. Yeah, and to go back to that concept that the Englishman has this, that these ideas come from national pride rather than reason, again, it raises one of his concepts about common sense, which is like, let's use our reason to really analyze these. If you're thinking your country is great just because you think your country is great, that's not a good enough reason to think your country is great, right? And the second point I want to make has to do with Canada. And I mentioned Canada in the introduction, and it always comes up kind of tangentially in these discussions when perhaps it should be more central. But in comparison to so-called French citizens in Canada, the English North American colonists, as opposed to the French ones who had then been conquered by Britain, the English colonists always thought that, you know, we are more free than you French subjects who have to bow down to the Catholic king and the papacy, and you don't have any of the freedoms that we do. So there is this kind of like anti-French, anti-Catholicism, we are better because we are Protestant, and we have the Magna Carta, basically. And Thomas Paine is just like, well, okay, yeah, we might have the Magna Carta and all of this stuff in these traditions, but, you know, there are more full versions of freedom that we can explore. Okay, so let's move on to section two here. This is of monarchy and hereditary succession is the title. And this is basically a long section that just savages kings throughout history. And it's quite fun. And if If you want to go back to figure out some reasons why kings are bad, read this section.
Yes. So this to me is really the, in some ways, it's kind of the heart of common sense, in that many of the preceding, let's say, if we want to go all the way back to the beginning, which of course from sort of the moment of the arrival of sort of British or then English colonists in North America, there was conflict with both sort of the denial of indigenous sovereignty, right, and sort of attacks on native land, but also conflict with British government back home, right? It's sort of never this sort of perfect state of salutary neglect, right? There's always some kind of tension happening. But we know that this begins to really boil up after the war, after the Seven Years' War, right? So if we look back to the sort of critiques that are really taking place in the 1760s, they're largely parliamentary critiques, right? There is still this consistent appeal to King George as a kind of a benevolent father figure, as the person who's keeping Parliament in line, who hears them, who understands them. There is a sort of famous statue of King George in New York City in Bowling Green that sort of is a tribute to George helping with the sort of Vile Stamp Act, right? Sort of all this discourse where the king, in a very sort of, it's essentially propaganda, but comes across sort of in a much more benevolent light in contrast to Parliament. And this is, if we're talking about age-old traditions, this goes all the way back to the Magna Carta and beyond that. This goes back to antiquity in all parts of the world, in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, where sort of the critique of, I'm not criticizing the king, I'm criticizing his bad ministers, right? That A, protects you from the direct wrath of an absolutist leader, essentially a dictator, a hereditary dictator. And it also provides a way of change that is not a full-blown revolution or attack on that leadership. And then all the instability that would come with it and all the everyday lives that would really be upended under that kind of turmoil. So this is not a new tactic that is being deployed here. And Paine sees this. Paine's aware. He's very, again, you know, he's very deeply steeped in this history. And he sees it and he rejects it. And as we know, he has words for Parliament as well, in common sense, right? He is in no way letting sort of Parliament off the hook in any capacity. But he rejects this whole notion of bad advisors as being the sort of driving force of monarchical misdeeds. And this is where I think you see the real break. The king is the source of the problem, because if we didn't have hereditary rule, the House of Lords wouldn't necessarily be the same kind of problem, right? If we didn't have aristocracy and people who, you know, to go back to that wonderful line, right? People who look upon themselves as born to reign. If you feel like from the cradle, you are owed power and owed authority, that's not going to make you a great leader. Right. And so if you eliminate this problem of hereditary or entitled power, entitled authority, you can really make some progress. And so that's why I think when we talk about common sense and we talk about that second section, that's really sort of the nuts and bolts of his argument about why people should support independence, because it's just irrational from him. He's like, why? Why? Because you're born into a certain cradle in a certain house. Does that mean that you are owed power that should belong to all of us?
And that's the a third founding idea of the U.S. as well. This idea that hereditary entitlements should not be the norm. But who knows if that's changed? I don't know. A funny passage that I like from this section, again, digging into the king. A pretty business indeed, Thomas Paine writes sarcastically, for a man to be allowed £800,000 sterling a year and to be worshipped in the bargain. Great to be a king. Of more worth is one honest man than all of the crowned ruffians that have ever lived. So, again, good stuff. The other thing that I noted in that section was, and this gets to the episode that we did on religion earlier, is that he actually, interestingly enough, goes to biblical history, mm-hmm. into the Bible, and he selects passages from the Bible that dispute many interpretations of the various Christian denominations in the colonies, and the pastors who are suggesting that the Bible says you must submit to the king because the God chose that person. Well, there are other passages in the Bible that say the exact opposite. So it was quite clever of him to kind of muddy the religious waters there and say, oh, wait, hold on a second. It is not indisputable that the Bible is all about subservience to the king.
Yeah, I mean, Payne is, again, deeply well-read, and while much was sort of made of his religiosity in later life, you know, the sort of critiques of him as an atheist, which are not borne out, right, by his own writings and voice, he does have sort of a spiritual belief system. He understands that Christian faith is a significant part of many colonial North Americans' lives, not all. Right? That's very important to also say, right? That is not all. The vision is not of sort of a religious state in any capacity. But he understands that faith is deeply important to many of his peers. And so communicating with the same kind of historical allusions he'd be using for other audiences, right? He is aware that connection is going to make an impact on his readers. And it is a pretty scathing critique of the divine right of kings, which, of course, he thinks there is no such thing.
Good. Okay, so let's move on to section 3, entitled Thoughts on the Present State of American Affairs. And this is quite a long section, too. And interestingly, he offers some ideas of how a republic should be organized, sort of a new constitutional order, and some other things. So what do you think is most important about Section 3?
I think Section 3 is important because it provides next steps. In some ways, and this is also maybe one of the many things, if it hasn't become obvious, that I find so striking about common sense, is its contemporary resonances. Something could be just as true in the late 18th century as it is true today. And it's very easy to criticize, right? It's very easy to point out all the things that are going wrong and doing wrong. To then meet those critiques with a solution is a very important next step. And so what I essentially read that section as is like, okay, I've just told you all the things that are not great, right, that are not good. Here is a way forward. Here is a solution. Here is a path forward. And I think that's a really important model to think about, that, okay, we have addressed the problem. Now we need to find the solution. And I think that's very astute choice.
Yeah, it's really pragmatic. You can't be complaining all the time without saying, and this is what can be done, and here's a plan. You know, yeah. It's just also, I would say, very, very American in a weird way. Something that struck me here that had some resonances with the Declaration of Independence is the passage that Britain hath stirred up the Indians and the Negroes to destroy us, which is referencing some real things happening, the alliances between the British Empire and some Indian tribes, and after Lexington and Concord, the practice of the British military to offer freedom for slaves who left their plantations and fought with the Redcoats. But I thought it was interesting because, of course, in the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson also references merciless Indian savages.
Correct.
And of course, the famous deleted passage from the Declaration of Independence excoriating the practice of enslaving people. Well, here we have the Negroes trying to destroy us, also in common sense. So, you know, there's two clear resonances here in that passage with the Declaration of Independence and Jefferson. To what extent did Thomas Paine's egalitarianism extend to Negroes, as he writes here, and Indians?
It's a great question and a very important one. So the short answer is it did and it didn't. In so many words. And why I say that is because there is indeed later evidence over the course of Paine's career of espousing anti-slavery positions. And he is relatively quiet on Indigenous American positions. He does not write very frequently about those questions. There are sort of writings here and there that certainly can be interpreted as to be, I would describe, as sort of mildly sympathetic to sort of federal encroachment on Native sovereignty, but not in a way that is sort of a substantial declaration or a substantial statement or part of his writing. I think he would, in principle, believe that those egalitarian rights extended to all people. How willing he was to advocate for those principles in practice when it came to Indigenous and African Americans, I am far less certain of what extent that would be. In so many words, if we think about the sort of contemporary nexus today of race, class, and gender, he is far more concerned with class than he is with race or gender. That being said, does he see some, what we might describe today as some degree of intersectionality between the three? I would say yes, but I don't think it's sort of the defining positions of his career. However, there is new work being done on pain and this subject and sort of attribution to his various works that may uncover more insight into Indigenous and African American perspectives on the rights of Indigenous and African Americans and his positions on slavery. And I very well think that new work could turn up, that new research may turn out much more nuanced insights than perhaps what I have just shared. In terms of the language in the Declaration itself, there are clear-cut resonances here. The section in the Declaration that remained about insurrection and the sort of phrase you used about disparaging terms, right, about Native Americans, Indigenous Americans. Insurrections is clearly a coded word to describe the revolt of enslaved people, right, against enslavement across the colonies. And that's what he is using, or the sort of the Committee of Five, the writers of the Declaration, are using in that terminology. Does Paine share share concerns about warfare with Native Americans and enslaved rebellion? Yeah, he says it in Common Sense that he shares those concerns. Whether he thinks they're going to be an issue in the long term in this sort of new republic that he envisions, that is less clear to me at this point. And importantly, right, the language that is cut from the Declaration, which expands on this issue in much more detail and is on the one hand far more critical of slavery in North America, explicitly critical of slavery in North America, but on the other hand, offloads all accountability and responsibility for that institution onto the British monarchy, is sort of a bit of a contradictory statement.
And I can't remember which section he already assumes the fact that the entire continent is for European settlers.
Yes.
And I can't remember what section that is. He's just like, oh, and if we have debts or whatever, all this land we have, we'll pay it off. Which is just like, boop, okay, that problem solved.
Well, this also goes back to the sort of the complications of the quote you mentioned earlier about sort of the cause of America is the cause of all mankind. I don't necessarily think that enslaved people would full stop agree with that. Now, on the one hand, you would like to be able to say you could agree with that because if the principles that are espoused here do in fact apply to all Americans, that might be the case. But certainly that does not necessarily apply to Indigenous Americans, right, who are explicitly excluded from the Republican experiment and also don't necessarily want to be part of it, right? Are fighting very intensely to maintain their sovereignty. So that cause would not be the cause of sort of Haudenosaunee Six Nations, right? That would not be the cause of the hundreds of Native nations.
Right. Okay. So this is another connection we see between the Declaration of Independence and then Thomas Paine's Common Sense. The one sense I do get, though, from Thomas Paine, in the pantheon of sort of hypocrites in the Founding Fathers, obviously we talk about Thomas Jefferson and his slave women with whom he had children and all this stuff, and the fact that he never really wanted to talk about the problem of slavery in his life. It was something that he couldn't quite resolve himself, and not to mention mistreatments of Native Americans who did actually help the rebellious colonists during the war itself at a later date, sort of selling them down the river. My sense of Thomas Paine, though, is that he's much more of an earnest idealist than, say, Thomas Jefferson or Washington or even Franklin, who were much more canny politicians and were getting involved in the rebellion business, not because they really believed in egalitarianism, but they kind of believed in egalitarianism, but they were also really protecting their own interests and trying to become more powerful themselves. Is that how you would judge his character?
When it comes to Payne specifically, all the evidentiary record indicates that these are very sincerely held beliefs, deeply so. And there's simply nothing in any evidence that I'm aware of that indicates that any of these beliefs are intended for sort of self-aggrandizement or self-benefit. And in fact, many of the choices he makes later in his life, which I know is beyond sort of the scope of our conversation today, don't go well for him. And they are sort of entangled with these principles, and in a way that if he had stronger self-preservation instincts, maybe he would have approached them differently. And yeah, I think they're very sincere, very, very much so. And he truly does believe in this potential, which again comes back to that cause of America. He really sees this, the potentials of something great. He really does. And is he thinking, as I would say, sort of expansively about what that means for all Americans, all people who reside in the North American continent? No, I don't think that is the case. But it is worth noting that Thomas Paine is not an enslaver. He does not ever own slaves in any capacity. He does not enslave anybody. He does have documented evidence that he has a real problem with this practice. Yes, is he an abolitionist? No, certainly not. But his positions in the realities, the overwhelming reality of the role of slavery in the early national United States and amidst the American Revolution, he is on the side that is opposed to this. He is. And he sticks with that position his entire life. Again, it is not his driving cause, right? His driving cause, as we will see in later works, you know, Age of Reason and Agrarian Justice, is not the cause that he is specifically focused on. But nonetheless, he is sincerely committed to egalitarian principles. And I do think that does distinguish him in some respects from his peers.
Nora, we do have a European audience, and this section 3, Thoughts on the Present State of American Affairs, does reference Europe a lot. And let me just read some passages, because I think our European audience today should get some sense of the attitudes amongst American colonialists who are from all over the world. Let's not forget what they were thinking of Europe and what Thomas Paine was saying about it. He says here in section 3, Europe and not England is the parent country of America. This new world, this America, hath been the asylum for the persecuted lovers of civil and religious liberty from every part of Europe. So again, we're already seeing this founding myth. America is the home of persecuted peoples in Europe. Hither have they fled, not from the tender embraces of the mother, but from the cruelty of the monster. And it is so far true of England that the same tyranny which drove the first emigrants from home pursues their descendants still. And this is one of the arguments he's using for those in the colonies here who are saying, oh, maybe we shouldn't really rebel. We're sitting on the fence. He's like, no, you know, Britain isn't our dad. King George isn't our daddy, to use some current weird language and current politics. And if so, our daddy is a monster.
Yeah.
And was persecuting us, which is why we left for America. And so let's not allow him back on our shores. You know, let's keep the daddy and the monster away.
Yeah, I think, and it's certainly very important to point out that colonial North America, and I want to be super deliberate with that language, because there is, you know, for indigenous North America, that is going to be a whole sort of parallel but separate set of responses to that statement, right? Which of course is that North America is in and of itself sort of a vibrant and diverse, multi-layered space for thousands and thousands of years before sort of Europe gets lost, right, and makes a wrong turn. So that, I think, is a very important preface to what Paine is describing there, because, of course, he is not thinking about that sort of fundamental lived reality of sort of the majority of North America. Where he is also right to observe, though, is that colonial North Americans are not exclusively British. English, Scottish, Welsh, Irish, right? They're not necessarily all coming from that particular part of the sort of English-speaking world, but they're also German, right? French, multiple other European immigrants
he
as well.
He mentioned specifically a little bit further along, he mentions Holland, Germany, or Sweden as all Europeans meeting in America, and we are all countrymen. And then he says, not even one third of the inhabitants of this province, Pennsylvania, where he's writing, are of English descent. Therefore, I reprobate the phrase of parent or mother applied to England only as being false, selfish, narrow, and ungenerous.
He's not wrong. He's not wrong in that, right? He's taking a very both and sort of anti the sort of peculiarities of the analogy within empire, right? Which is sort of this familial relationship, which is actually an entirely extractive one. And yes, in the particular case of British North America, North American colonists have a much higher quality of life and the much vast other, imperial dominions around the world where, you know, people, resources, cultures are just extracted over and over again. That is not, like you said, that is not a familial relationship. And if it is one, it's a devastating and tragic and horrifying one. But so that critique makes a lot of sense. The other point, though, that these are actually far more diverse in the European sense of the word, as well as in the sort of multi-continental sense of the word, right? That there are multitudes of African descended people and indigenous people also all moving in this milieu is an important observation. Where I would hesitate a little bit or provide a little bit more context for that particular paragraph, he is making an anti-nationalist argument, right? He is critiquing English nationalism or British nationalism in so many words. That's what he's trying to do there. What that doesn't necessarily take into account is that many of those countries also have their own imperial dominions in other parts of the world, including sort of the Americas in the Western Hemisphere, and are not necessarily any better at quote-unquote empire than the British are. So that's, I think, another point to make too, that while he is certainly correct in that assessment, he's looking very specifically at Britain and not necessarily engaging with the imperial histories of like Holland, for example, or France or these other countries.
Good. And just a couple or maybe one final point about section three is he does try to encourage people as he's saying, you know, we can solve this problem. People are worried. Well, you know, we don't have a navy. We don't have this and that. We might lose trade. He's always saying like, listen, yeah, we don't have a navy, but we can build one because we have all the tar and wood, right? We have our own ports. We have our own shipbuilders. We'll build our own navy. We don't need someone else to protect us. And then, of course, the other thing about trade, he's like, well, so what if we can't trade with Britain because we rebel? We'll trade with the rest of the world on our own ships. So, again, lots of practical solutions here. And lastly, he ends this section with this ridiculous passage. Again, looking at it from now, 250 years in the future. And there are a lot of exclamation points in here. Oh, ye that love mankind, ye that dare oppose not only the tyranny, but the tyrant, stand forth. Every spot of the old world is overrun with oppression. Freedom hath been hunted round the globe. Asia and Africa have long expelled her. Europe regards her like a stranger. And England hath given her warning to depart. Oh, receive the fugitive and prepare in time an asylum for mankind. Again, he's really setting kind of like the intellectual groundworks for everything that we celebrate when we Americans celebrate the 4th of July, freedom and all that stuff. And it's just really weird. Anyway.
Yeah, this is also a very pro-immigrant book. And I think that needs to be said very loudly, very repeatedly, in a way that is absolutely enduring across time and space. On the one hand, yes, are some of the statements that we just listened to not necessarily thinking about, particularly in the mention of Africa and sort of the imperial abuses that have led to sort of the transatlantic slave trade and what influence that has had? Yes, there is like a real lack of, he is not engaging in that when he speaks of Africa or other parts of the world, right? But he is observing, at least when it comes to Europe, this is a continent that is dominated by monarchies, and that hereditary monarchy without the counterweight of republicanism or a constitutional monarchy or republican monarchy is essentially authoritarianism. It's essentially a dictatorship. That is what it is. We use different terms, but he is seeing it and he is calling it exactly what he sees it as and making an argument that no matter where you are from, Europe, Asia, Africa, other parts of the world, and he explicitly does say all parts of the world, come here. Come here. Whether or not those places have actually forgotten about freedom is not correct, but he is making a clear point that immigrants are welcome and in fact encouraged to be here.
And one of the criticisms we see in the Declaration of Independence, and I can't remember which specific grievance it is, it's not in front of me, but I did an episode on this, like maybe episode 3, was that King George was preventing immigrants from coming, which was bad for the colonial economy, and that the
it's
only way
business.
The colonies could prosper is with more people to buy their stuff and to make more stuff.
Yeah. Immigrants are really good for business. That was true in the 18th century, and it's true now. And So, and they are aware of this. When we talk about politics for people of this period, it is political economy, right? Politics and commerce are completely interwoven in the best sense and in the worst sense when it comes to sort of humanity and sort of human enslavement and human trafficking. So it's really important to bear that in mind, right? That they don't see this as separate conversations.
Good. Okay. Let's go to the final section here. There is an appendix after that. But section 4 is called Of the Present Ability of America, with some miscellaneous reflections. I just have a quick note here that says, America can be powerful. That's my summary. Do you want to say anything more deep than that?
I think that pretty much gets us where we need to go. He's got high hopes. He's got high hopes. He thinks that the American experiment can truly be this beacon for, can be strong. And maybe the best way to put it is that for him, he sees America, he doesn't see power as domineering or cruel or harmful, but he's envisioning American power or the potential of it as something that is potentially inclusive and welcoming and a safe haven for people who believe in egalitarianism and those principles.
And I might say he also mentions religious freedom in this section too.
Yes, of course.
So maybe just a question of speculation here. Thomas Paine, what do you think he would think about the state of this country that he pretty much intellectually founded or helped to found 250 years ago?
Well, he was certainly a key contributor. I've grappled with this question a fair amount. Thank you for asking it. It's a really exciting one and also a difficult one, because on the one hand, Paine lives in a very different time than today, right? We talked about just the way the media landscape alone was substantially different. And yet, there are such strong connections, both in media and more broadly, between the revolutionary period and 2025, or as we lead into 2026, that do set up an important parallel between them. In other words, it would be curious to know what Paine might think about America today, because there are these links that are so formative that he was a key communicator and a key interlocutor on. So in so many words, what do I think he would think of the state of America today? My opinion is that he would be both amazed at its potential and pretty devastated at its disregard for what that potential has provided. I think that so much of our understanding of this period has to be a balance between these incredible principles, these absolutely extraordinary, powerful ideas, and all the potentials that they offer, and the ways in which those potentials have not been reached yet, the ways in which they have fallen short or been actively ignored. And I think Paine would see both. He would see both the peaks and the valley. He would see how the remarkable sustainability of American institutions, and there'd be just so much to admire, the expansion of suffrage, he was an activist. He believed what we might describe today in social justice. Like, he would be, I think, very impressed by the work of people over the last 250 years to reach that American promise. And I also think he would be very devastated by the ways in which that is taken for granted, the ways in which, by some actors, I should say, of course, not all, the ways in which those rights are dismissed or diminished or actively attacked. This is a man who is a great believer in education, a great believer in what we describe today sort of as libraries and public knowledge. And he'd be both, I think, in awe.
Free expression.
Of those. Yes, yes. He'd be in awe and I think really impressed by so much of what the United States has done in those spaces. And also, again, I keep going back to this word, pretty devastated at the ways in which many of those institutions and practices are under attack. I think he'd be pretty mesmerized by social media in the best way and the worst way. I think he'd be very, very active on X and on TikTok and so on and so forth in a way that would be both wildly entertaining and also probably really terrible for him.
We should create an AI avatar of Thomas Paine and put it on TikTok.
It's funny that you say this. Actually, at the ITPS, we are working on a Paine
yes.
AI project. I do not think it's going to go in that direction, to be very clear. But we are sort of playing around. We are doing some a student led project or a student involved project here. It's been very exciting.
We can have him troll the current king of Britain.
Oh my gosh, he'd be a total troll. You would love it.
Okay.
You'd love it.
Yeah. Okay. I just, as you were talking, I pulled out this last quotation about Thomas Paine in the present. This was in the appendix to which was written, I think, maybe 6 months after the first edition. And if we all listeners and you just substitute Republican and Democrat for Whig and Tory here, listen to what Thomas Paine says. Let the names of Whig and Tory be extinct. And let none other be heard among us than those of a good citizen, an open and resolute friend, and a virtuous supporter of the rights of mankind and of the free and independent states of America. I think he might be repeating that a lot today.
Yes. Yeah. Those are very powerful words, and they hold up.
I've asked you about Thomas Paine and what he would think about America today, but I always ask my guests a concluding question. Here you are, a historian and expert in Thomas Paine and this part of American history. When you think of the Declaration of Independence after 250 years, what do you think?
I would say that I have three key thoughts, feelings, opinions about the Declaration that are both formed by my work as a historian, as a scholar, as a teacher, as a writer, as well as a citizen of the United States, as someone who cares very deeply about their country and the many communities that I'm a part of within it. I'm actually just thinking about the quotation you just read from Common Sense about sort of being a good person and a good neighbor, and also sort of caring about your civic community. And I think the first thing that stands out to me about the Declaration, and has for quite some time, is that it really is an antidote to rugged individualism. It's very much a statement of the civic and collective nature of democracy. And yes, our individuality, our individual views are so important, and they're how we move through the world, right? But we don't move through the world alone. Like, we are bound together in obligation to each other. And the Declaration is essentially saying we are a part of this. We have gone through this. We are taking this step together. This is not I, this is we. And that will consistently remain sort of at the front of my mind when I think about this document. The other thing that I think about, the second point, which is deeply interconnected with my pretty perpetual rereading of Common Sense, is the inherent danger of demagogues, whether they are kings, dictators, or any other form of authoritarianism, of hereditary rule in this sort of spectrum of unelected governance, we might say. this is the alarm bells, right? This is the warning sign that it is incredibly important to be wary of the danger of one person holding all the power. No matter how extraordinary or ordinary that person might be, regardless of their qualifications or lack thereof, there is a danger in one person having absolute authority. And the Declaration could not be clearer, warning us to the present day about what's at risk with that. And so the third and final thought that I often have about the Declaration is really a combination of its promises and its pitfalls. In other words, there are extraordinary principles in this document, absolutely extraordinary, inspiring principles that provide us a blueprint as a country to work towards, right? How to best actualize a true democracy, a truly egalitarian country. And on the other hand, even within the document itself, we see the ways in which the nation has fallen short on many of those principles, the way the document treats Indigenous Americans and enslaved Americans and African-descended people, African-Americans. As we move to the 250th anniversary of independence, I think it's incredibly important to consider how best to actualize those principles and make sure we address the ways in which, as a country, we have fallen short.
Okay, Professor Nora Stronimsky, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americacentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.